B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the man talking in your backswing, Charlie Nance.
Hey there, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. You know, in a way, this feels like Super Bowl Sunday. You're fired up for the game, but you know this means no more football for months. Now, granted, the Tour Championship is not the Super Bowl, but even though the wraparound season begins in just a couple of weeks, we won't get any meaningful golf until next year. And yes, I'm including the President's Cup because the U.S. is just going to wax an overmatched international squad. This week, we'll check in at East Lake in Atlanta with two of my favorite journalists in the game, Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, and Rex Hoggard, senior writer with the Golf Channel. Also, we'll talk about last week's U.S. Amateur Championship contested at Pinehurst with one who participated, Carolina amateur golfing icon and current USGA four-ball champ, Scott Harvey. But we begin in Atlanta with Ron Green Jr. Ron, let's start with Medina last week. I was intrigued by a tweet you sent out. Remember when Medina was a tough golf course? I watched it happen at Pebble Beach at the U.S. Open. Now I've watched it happen in Medina. And I really think that JT put it best. Look, I don't care how long you make it. You give us a soft course with great greens and we're going to kill you. And there's nothing anyone can do about that.
No, I think that was pretty evident. You know, what was it? Tiger said, you couldn't imagine 20 under not being good enough at Medina of all places. Now, and all the talk about how low the scores were there, I did go back and look. Tiger won the PGA Championship there and shot 18 under the second time he won a PGA there. So there was some mild precedent, I guess. But, I mean, it just spoke to, you want to see the modern game in full display, there it was. Now, they had optimum conditions at Medina with not much wind, soft green, soft fairways. And so they just, you know, sometimes it's, you hear players talking about, they get in a threesome Thursday or Friday and they feed off each other. One guy starts playing well, then the next two guys sort of fall in and there's almost a momentum. It's kind of felt like that at Medina, that once guys started shooting some scores maybe a little lower than they initially thought, then everybody said, well, why not me, and kept going. Turns out, you know, the 60 nothing that Justin shot on Saturday was just sublime. You know, I mean, that was beautiful. And, you know, he had things happen to the, you know, pitching in, then holing out an 8-iron, things that sort of turned terrific rounds into spectacular rounds. But, yeah, that's what they can do when it gets going like that.
I read an article online this morning, and it was comparing scores and adventures from a U.S. Open that was held at Medina versus the scores and adventures that were held last weekend. And if you want any evidence as to a change in equipment, the guys were hitting 7-irons at most into 17, which is a long par 3 over water. And in the article I read this morning, it was discussing Ben Crenshaw rinsing a 2-iron off of that tee back in the day. I mean, that's a huge, huge change in equipment.
Yeah, I mean, I think someone, when they moved it all the way back, hit some 5-irons there. But it's just, you know, some of the angles, I mean, if they have giant trees. I mean, even by tree standards, the ones they have at Medina are big. And, you know, they would just stand there and aim it right over. They could hit the driver so far, so high. And, you know, Adam Scott talked about it, started a whole discussion that, you know, he says the driver's now the easiest club in the bag to hit. I don't know that that's fully translated down to my level yet, but certainly on their level, they play with so little fear of the driver. Now, it'll be different at East Lake this week because the Bermuda rough is such at East Lake that if you don't hit it in the fairway, there is a penalty because there's shots where you have to cover some bunkers and things and you have much less control. So, we've talked about it through the years. I mean, the game has just warped into something different, better or worse. I mean, we can argue that, but what we've saw last week is that's the classic example of what the game has become.
Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking dead aim. You mentioned the rough height at Eastlake. We discussed this after the Ryder Cup that was in France last year. Isn't that the solution? Since I think we both will agree that the toothpaste is out of the tube, there's not going to be bifurcation. I just don't see them rolling back equipment. So isn't the answer in raising the mower height a little bit and making the rough a little more penal and bringing in the fairways, isn't that how you can combat some of this?
I would disagree about bifurcation. I think they will get the bifurcation.
Do you really believe that?
I think they should get the bifurcation. And there was a lot of rough in Medina last week. Now, when you soften the fairway, suddenly they get wider because the ball's not going to
release.
Away.
Yeah.
But I think the great equalizer are firm greens and wind. We saw what Pinehurst was like with the U.S. Amateur, and it was probably too hard. But that's what firm and fast can do, and you throw it on, obviously, that set of greens. But you can't control the weather. You can't get it firm and fast, particularly in the south in the summertime, like here at Eastlake. I mean, you're going to get some thunderstorms. It's going to, the greens are not going to be as crusty as they maybe want them to be. But I just think that they are they're going to have to – they've run out of room in the corners of greens already in terms of putting flag sticks. So I think you just have to surrender to it at a certain point, unless you just make it totally goofy. And, Adam said, length is not going to scare them. So you got to find another way if you want to scare them. Now, you can make the other argument. Hey, we know how hard golf is. Isn't it cool to sit back and watch these guys make it look kind of easy? It's not easy. It's certainly easier for them than it was for the best players 25, 30 years ago because the equipment's made it that. It doesn't make it an easy game, but I marvel at what they can do and how consistently they can do it.
I do, too. You bring up that you think bifurcation is going to happen. Do you think it happens more on the equipment side in terms of clubs, or is the big easy solution or the quick solution to dial back the ball?
I think they will find. I think they could do a couple things. I mean, there's the compelling argument. Just shrink driver heads. Take them back to what they used to be, and so the sweet spot gets smaller. The penalty for, the margin of error for a miss changes. David Faraday has always argued, and I'm not a scientist, that just make the ball a little bigger and it solves all the problems. It won't go as far. I think they play a bifurcated game right now anyway. What they're playing, your driver may look like the driver Brooks Koepka or Dustin Johnson is hitting, but it's really not.
Oh, yeah, there's only about $1,000 difference between their shaft and mine.
Yeah, what they're playing and what they're using and all that is a little different. And, I think, the game's different in pretty much every sport. I mean, you could use the example of Major League Baseball. They use wooden bats. They don't use aluminum bats like everybody else does there once you get to that level. I think if you're going to try to bring something back, I think you could bring back the driver more may be easier than the ball. Now, I don't think they need to touch it for us, but I think when you get to the certain level, I think they're searching for a way to do something. I know that, whether you're listening to Martin Slumbers or listening to Mike Davis talk about the distance survey they're undertaking, you get a sense that maybe they're getting closer to making some, profound announcement. I don't know. That's sort of like slow play policy. We're almost there. I mean,
yeah.
Monahan was asked about the tour's progress on the slow play policy this week. He said, I'm very excited about where we're going, and quoted Amy Bockstedt and said, we've got this. Well, okay, let's see it, and maybe we'll see it soon. But anyway, that's a rambling answer to a bunch of things.
Well, if you were going to put an over-under on years between now and when we will actually see an equipment difference, just your gut feeling between the pro game and our game, how long are we looking?
I would guess 5 years. I don't know if I would bet on what I'm saying, but I just think there is so much discussion. You know, I sense something's going to change, but, you know, I mean, you can go back and dig up all the quotes from the Jones era or from, you know, two or three eras, days gone by, and they said the same thing. The ball's going too far. The game has changed, blah, blah, blah. And it sounds a lot like what we're saying now. But I think you start getting into the reality of how much land is needed and how so much of what has made been, you know, treasured in terms of golf course and everything are being sort of overwhelmed, that I think that may be what prompts some action, if there ever is any.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking dead aim. You referenced Jay Monahan's State of the Union address this week. Let's discuss a couple of things. You mentioned the slow play issue, and I was amused by his answer as well. Very political. Hey, we got this. We met on this earlier in the year. Everybody's excited about where we're going, and that was it. The European Tour this week announced that they were going to be doing something. Their method was interesting. Do you see the PGA Tour adopting that same sort of method?
Yeah, I don't know. I think what was interesting about the European Tour thing is when you went back and read what their previous policy was, that they basically didn't have one. You had to fall out of position before you sort of fell under their surveillance, and then you needed five bad times before you could potentially be penalized, which explains why they never ever penalized anybody. I think Jay did point out, he pointed out two or three things they've changed. He said we've made the cut to 65 now from low 70 and 65, and took away the MDF thing for when they have a bigger field, which hints to the fact that they know it. Fewer players means you play faster, and so by limiting how many players make the cut, that helps speed the long. Opposite field events are going from 125 to 100 players, things like that. Rory McIlroy said it sitting in the media center. He said, that's the simple answer, just reduce the field sizes. Now, it's easy for Rory to say because he's in everything, and, you know, you get the rank and file talking about playing opportunities. But I think one of the first steps, and having set in golf carts with tour officials through the years and heard them talk about it, that 156 players is too many to expect anything better than what they have now. So I think that would be a step. And you could counteract it by saying, well, now there's whatever, 47 events where there used to be 30-some to 40-some. You know, the number keeps creeping up. I'll be interested to see what Jay and the tour come out with. I don't think it's going to be earth-shaking, but I think Lucas Glover, you need track shoes to follow Lucas around. He said, you know, we've been talking about it in a locker room for 15 years and bashing people for it. We know what it is. And, you know, we talk about it, and nothing ever changes. He goes, and it feels to me like this is the tour being reactive more than proactive. And it does feel like that, given what's sort of boiled up over the past 3 or 4 weeks.
But, well, I found it somewhat ironic that this all got started because of something that the tour instituted for the common man. This got started because of PGA Tour Live and their featured groups on the early morning rounds, where it is unedited, and so you see everything in these groups rounds. And, you know, I will be stunned if you ever see Bryson DeChambeau, Kevin Na, or JB Holmes on featured groups ever again, just to try to avoid this situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a much bigger deal on Thursdays and Fridays, too. You know, there was no real issue with pace of play last week at Medina. However, I will say on Saturday, you had Patrick Cantlay. Why am I suddenly drawing a blank? Who was in the last group? But they were two holes behind.
Oh, and Matsuyama, yeah.
They were two holes behind. Now, Justin Thomas was playing a group in front of them, and when you only hit it, whatever, 61 times or whatever, you know, it didn't take very long. Could see, you know, the grinding going on there. But, you know, Brooks Koepka, like he said, I just don't understand why, you know, you have to wait till they put the pin in, walk off screen before you start everything. You should be ready to go by then and just figure out if the wind's done anything to change. I think the more they talk about it, the more they push it, the more likelihood there is of something, because I don't think talking to and listening to some players. If they don't change anything, they understand that the public's going to look at them and just sort of shake their head.
Something that I found interesting from Monahan's press conference that I didn't realize was as big a priority as he insinuates that it is, and that is having a simultaneous event with the LPGA Tour. Twice he said it's a priority. I didn't even realize it was a thing.
He told us in 2017 when I was toughing it out in that meeting room in Maui with him that was the big deal. They were working toward it, and there was a thought that they could do a tournament of champions concurrently at Maui, at Kapalua, with the LPGA and what the tour has. And then the LPGA decided to do its own tournament of champions, I think, in Florida, and sort of kill that. Now, he said they're getting close on something else. He wouldn't let on in any form or fashion where that might be, but I think he wants to make that happen down the road, probably sooner rather than later. But, yeah, it's a priority. I think there are higher priorities, but I think he was trying to make the point that it's not something they're sort of just letting drift out there, that they're aware that that's something that's been talked about and they could make happen.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. East Lake Tour Championship, new format where we've got seating. Justin Thomas, who doesn't need help from anyone, is getting shots from everyone. We'll see how that plays out. I'm kind of scratching my head as to what I think about that to start a tournament out. To me, it kind of boils down to a couple of things. How interested is Brooks Koepka this week in making $15 million? And can Rory McIlroy putt? What are some other things that you think are going to decide the winner on Sunday?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. I tried to keep an open mind about the whole format thing. I know they're trying to, they want it to be a big playoff feel. And Justin Thomas, the way he jumped from where he was to where he is starting this tournament exemplifies that. I know Koepka is engaged in one. He's really been struggling with his game and used the term, said he was actually freaking out about it because suddenly he, long game, even putting, said nothing felt right. He said, I would feel like I'm trying to hit these little little draws down there and I'm hitting this other shot. And he said that I had no feel. What I was feeling was not what was happening. And as we said, that was freaking me out. And I felt like I couldn't make any putts, and he said, I realized I just wasn't hitting the ball hard enough and going through it and sounded like a guy who was like you're hot and sweaty and you just want to freshen up, and finally he'd gotten out of that shower, felt different again and sounded like a guy who's very enthusiastic about his chances down here. I think Rory McIlroy, if he could win this tournament, and he starts five back, and he was five back with 36 holes to play when he won this in the FedEx Cup 3 years ago. He could make the case that he would have had three wins this year, including the FedEx Cup, the Players' Championship in Canada, and it would be 14 top tens and 19 starts. Do you reward, if you wanted to stretch the Player of the Year argument out, does that year-long excellence trump, Koepka's 1-2, 1-2, or whatever it was in the majors, plus, he won a WGC? I don't know. It's only possible. I mean, Rory would have to do that for it to become a discussion, but he's had an excellent year, one of the best years of his career. But I think there's been a couple times when he didn't finish off, had a bad Sunday in Memphis, I guess, and it is sort of shadowed a little bit how good his year actually has been. And I think he can make some putts. I think these greens are so good at East Lake that if you just get it online, you've got a really good chance. Those are interesting things. I think Patrick Cantlay sits out there as quietly a guy who loves the competition and loves this opportunity and is waiting for that big moment to sort of elevate where he is in the game, and this could be it.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And when we return, Carolina amateur golfing legend and current USGA four-ball champ Scott Harvey takes Dead Aim at last week's U.S. Amateur held at Pinehurst, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
We're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Scott Harvey is the son of a Carolina golfing legend, Bill Harvey. He's not so shabby himself, having won countless amateur events in the Carolinas and elsewhere, including the USGA Mid-Am, and is currently one half of the USGA Four-Ball Champions. He's played on the Walker Cup and last week competed in the U.S. Amateur held at Pinehurst. Well, Scott, let's start with this. It didn't go as well as you wanted it to at Pinehurst last week. I know that you love that place as much as all of us love that place, and just wasn't your week. But I want you to speak first as to your impressions of Pinehurst number 4 as set up by the USGA for a championship golf course. What did you think about number 4?
I thought number 4 was great. The redesign, kind of matched the feel of number 2 in the sense that they took out the rough and put them in natural areas, everywhere, and everything about it was great. If I could have changed one thing, I would have, the second hole, it's normally a par 5. They made it a par 4, but that green, not quite designed to be a 525-yard par 4, and I shouldn't be complaining because I did make a 3 on it, but I guess what I'm saying is if I could change one thing, that would really be it. And that says a lot because normally I have a list of complaints. But no, that's a great course, a great place, and I was very excited to see number 4 and the changes done. It's really nice.
At the beginning of last week in the medal portion of the competition, there was a significant difference in terms of strokes needed to survive number 4 than to survive number 2. I've seen number 2 set up tough and playing tough. Even for the U.S. Opens, I don't think I've ever seen number 2 play as tough as it was at the beginning of last week. Have you?
No, and you mentioned the difference of the two. I've never seen a over 4 shot variance in 2 courses that are being used for a tournament. That's a lot. It was pretty baked out too, and it was just extremely hard to hit those greens, how they're sloped and everything. I mean, you had to hit perfect shots just to be on the green. It was difficult, but you know what? There's nothing wrong with difficult. You just kind of throw the score window mentally and just try to play golf the best you can.
You mentioned on number 4 on hole number 2 how they had made that in to a par 4. I sat up in my chair. I was watching on the weekend when I got back from a trip out to New Mexico, and I saw that number 16 on number 2 was being played as a 525-yard or 524-yard par 4. And that will never play as anything but a par 5 for me. I'm never even doing that. But I was imagining that when you start to alter holes like that into greens that aren't designed, as you said, to be receptive, there's got to be some just scary shots out on that golf course where the margin for error is so slim, especially on number 2, that it just, you had to stand over a ball and just go, oh, my God, here goes nothing.
That's right. And that's right. And, then you throw in greens that were designed back when they ran, 7 on the stimp meter. Now they're 13.5, and it's a combination that, like I said, it's fun as long as you can accept the fact that good shots are not always going to turn out in good places.
North Carolina amateur golfing legend Scott Harvey, current USGA four-ball champion Scott Harvey, is our guest taking Dead Aim. I had a conversation with Matt Wharton, who's the superintendent at Carolina here in Charlotte, where they played a round in the Mid-Am a year ago. And I was asking him about the course setup of his golf course as instructed by the USGA, because when I think of Carolina, I think of really long par threes, 212 and 220-yard par threes, and they're beautiful. And he said, they changed them up because the USGA wanted to put different clubs in their hands for each of the par threes. And I noticed that that was the same way that number two was set up. For instance, on Sunday, I don't know if you watched the final match, but the hole number nine, which I don't think I've ever played at anything less than 160, 170 yards, was all of a sudden playing at 135. And I was thinking to myself, I didn't even know there was a 135-yard tee box on right. hole number nine. What are your thoughts of changing, of doing those kind of things on par threes? Because I actually think that's a good idea.
I think it is, too. And you know, it's kind of boring. You can have different par threes that may look different, but if you're hitting a six iron to every single one of them, it just makes it more fun. The more clubs you're hitting in, you're hitting a different variety of shots. It gives you some different looks. I really like that whole thought process there. Matter of fact, I think in stroke play on that hole, I hit gap wedge. Which I'd never done. I'm with you.
No, you got me. I don't know if that exists in my bag. And, you know, I thought at first like I was reading the TV wrong or somebody got it wrong with Fox.
Yeah.
But, really? They're playing? Wow, that's neat. Scott, the amateur game just keeps getting better and better and better. I don't know. Did you watch the final match?
I did. You know, I watched. Not all of it, but I definitely watched probably the last 8 or 10 holes, somewhere in there.
See, I picked it up.
John Augustine, and I don't know Ogletree, so nothing against him, but I was pulling for John in the sense that I know him, and he's a great person and a great player.
I really get a kick. I like to see somebody win rather than somebody lose. And so I liked what I saw on Sunday. And not since I saw Doug Gim and Doc Redman, to me, had the final match in my lifetime out at Riviera a few years ago. That was just a clinic in great golf. But this was really, really good stuff in that coming down the stretch, Augustine had a 2-shot lead and he made a tactical decision that was not wrong. You know, on 14 or 15, putting it in that greenside bunker on the left. Again, they had the tee box on that hole moved up. Whereas Ogletree, played like a 7 or 6 iron off the tee and then a sand wedge in. It worked out for Ogletree. Augustine missed the next putt. You know, I thought that was just really great golf. And sometimes people complain about the modern game. That there's no nuance anymore and there's no strategy anymore. It's just bomb and gouge. And that, to me, was a stunning example of how nuance is played with modern equipment and just thinking your way around a golf course.
Yeah, and the USGA, to their credit, they try to throw a curveball at you and make you make decisions that and use your brain a little bit. And that's a perfect example of how a decision can be made and affect the outcome, and it doesn't have to be a 530-yard par four for it to happen. And it's a shame there's not more of that going on, honestly, meaning, for example, the hardest or the best short par four in the world I've ever played is 8 at Pine Valley, like 320 yards. And, I mean, it is brutal. It's absolutely brutal, as it's supposed to be for a 320-yard par four. Again, it doesn't have to be super long and crazy just to make an impact on an event.
Well, and again, it was a situation on that hole especially where neither one made the wrong decision. They made the decision that worked best for them. I mean, Augustine has just a nasty short game. He's great out of a trash can. And he made a really good bunker shot out of that left green. He left himself 5 or 6 feet, or left edge or just outside left for birdie. You can't really ask for more. If you had asked him on the tee, I'll give you 5 feet for birdie right now. Will you take it? He'd say absolutely. And it just didn't. Right, and it just didn't work out. I just thought it was really, really smart by the USGA and showed some really, really smart golf. Scott Harvey, Carolina golfing legend, amateur golfing legend, is our guest taking Dead Aim. Before we get off the U.S. amateur, I wanted to ask you about the tee gift. That I saw you post a picture of it. That's one of the coolest things I've ever seen. Sort of tell people what it was.
Yeah, really cool. It's a little wooden American flag that's kind of with a little stand that you can display in your house. It's made actually out of the wood from the fallen trees from the hurricane that came through, I guess it was last year. And really neat, I think it's the Heritage Flag Company. is what it's called.
Right.
And just a really neat place. I actually went to the store. I liked the thing so much, and I was trying. Well, my wife stopped me from spending $1,500 in there, but I wanted to buy a whole bunch of things. Like, you know, it's just a really cool thing. I love the flag and how it looks and what it stands for. And for me, I just love that kind of stuff. So it really stood out.
Yeah, I thought it was neat. I saw the feature Fox did on it and went, wow, that is really, really cool. So the announcement of the Walker Cup came following the U.S. Amateur, and you're not on it this year. You didn't really play enough, and you knew the chances were that you're not going to be on there. As I look at the list, your friend and rival Stuart Hagestad appears to be the only mid-am player that is on the team this year, and you and I have discussed how we sort of have felt like the USGA was looking to phase out in the mid-ams and how we're sort of against that philosophy. However, a decision that the USGA recently made in which the amateurs do not lose their – the amateur champions and runner-ups do not lose their exemptions into the next year's U.S. Open by turning professional. Do you think that that might have an impact on Walker Cup teams going forward in terms of guys going ahead and turning professional because they know that their exemption in the U.S. Open won't be affected?
That's a good point. Never really thought about that. I definitely think that you're going to have some kids turning pro earlier for sure. I didn't really think about it from a Walker Cup impact standpoint, but I think what you'll see is a lot of kids go to the Masters and turn pro the next week now instead of waiting on the Open. And I never really thought about what you just said. That's interesting. Yeah, I think it might. I mean, you know, if they're going to wait for the U.S. Open, they might as well wait for the Walker Cup, right? But this, they don't have to wait for the U.S. Open anymore, so that's a good point.
Well, and something tells me that, you know, it's not going to be long before the Masters follow suit and the Open Championship follow suit, and then there's really going to be no reason for them to hold on to their amateur status. They can go ahead and just turn pro at the end of the summer and hold on to their exemptions into those events, and I really think that will really open up the Walker Cup for the mid-ams.
I would hope so. You know, it shouldn't be about essentially a springboard for those kids to just jump, you know, turn professional, so to speak. I mean, it really, lifelong amateurs are the heart and soul of the game of golf, and I would like to see them rewarded a little bit more than they are in a lot of ways.
Get you out of here on this. Scott Harvey, Carolina amateur golfing legend and current USGA four-ball champion, is our guest taking dead aim. If there's one thing that I've always liked about you and respected about you, it's your commitment to the imprint and the brand of amateur golf. I loved it a couple of years ago. You have hosted a junior tournament with your dad's name on it the last couple of years. I assume that's going to continue. And then sort of tell me about this tournament that I saw announced that you're going to be involved with, because I think this further, you know, establishes your imprint and brand in amateur golf.
Yeah, so team golf is, I think it's everybody's favorite in a sense that, you know, you're sharing everything with everyone. You have a partner. It's just, you know, golf's very much an individual sport, and team competitions are few and far between, but in some ways have a way of launching guys to the next level, meaning, you know, from one tier to the next, not necessarily to a professional game. I just mean like from a B tier to an A tier player. But long story short, the idea has been floated out there before, the East-West matches, best players from the East versus the best players from the West, and in a team competition. And for whatever reason, it just hasn't ever made it to the finish line. And I've put my mind on it and put my heart and soul into it, and it got across the finish line recently. Made the announcement that it's coming next year in the fall of 2020 at Merida Golf Club down in Dallas, Texas.
There may be finer gentlemen in the game. I just haven't met them. That's Carolina amateur golfing legend Scott Harvey. And up next, back to Atlanta we go as Golf Channel senior writer Rex Hoggard takes dead aim at the FedEx Cup Finals and the Tour Championship at Eastlake, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Rex Hoggard is a senior golf writer with the Golf Channel and is on the beat at the FedEx Cup Finals and Tour Championship at East Lake in Atlanta. Rex, I want to start with what we saw in Medina last week. I think a lot was made over the low scoring, but if you do a little research, Tiger won a PGA there in 06 and he got it to 18 under, so it's really not that big an increase, is it?
It's really not, especially when you consider what they did at the Ryder Cup there just a few years after that, where they essentially took all the rough out. It was Augusta National with no rough whatsoever, and they set it up for the American team. They wanted them to bomb it. They wanted them to make birdies, and it's that kind of golf course, and that's what we end up getting. It was funny today to hear Roy McIlroy talk about the scoring differences between last week and this week at East Lake, and he kind of smiled, and he goes, if you'd have told me I'd have finished 20 under and not even been in the top five, I probably wouldn't have believed it. And gives you an idea. Guys are still a little shell-shocked. They know they're good. When you see scores like that on tour courses, it is still a little surprising.
You know, you're not going to get that at East Lake this week because of the just gnarly Bermuda rough that they have. And we learned this at the Ryder Cup last year in France. If everybody's got a problem, isn't the answer just narrow the fairways and raise the mower height in the rough, and that'll solve a lot of this?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess if we want to sit around and really worry about what lanes or distance gains have done to the game, I guess Le Golf National is the solution, right? I mean, I know we're taking this to the extreme, but I think you're right that if we're really worried about it, he was a perfect example where Thomas Bjorn, the European captain, did a brilliant job setting up a golf course that didn't play to any American strength and pretty much played to his entire team's strength outside of Rory, which is interesting. He took one of his best players out of the mix, so to speak, just to give his team the best chance. And I think that's probably the solution everyone falls back on, but having been in Paris, and I'm sure you watched it on TV, it wasn't the most exciting or entertaining golf to watch.
So at the end of the day, it's still, as the cliche goes, it's still a TV show. You've got to remember that we're trying to put butts in seats and trying to keep them tuned in. It's entertainment, and I think some people lose sight of that.
I think so, but I kind of equate this, and I was having this conversation with my son the other day, because you know the way teenagers are, they know everything. He was lecturing me about how far they're hitting the ball in baseball this season and all the home runs, and we all know what's going on there. And he was kind of, you know, making a big deal about, these stats shouldn't mean anything this season. It's skewed. And the only thing I thought is, well, it kind of happens in every sport, right? So it's happened in baseball. It's certainly happening in golf right now. But I think at some point you do have to scale it back and find some sort of happy medium that, no, I don't think anyone would want to see 20-something under winning like it did last week at Medina every single week in and week out on the PGA Tour. But if you get something closer to probably what we're going to have this week, if you take the stroke space out of it, the winner's probably going to be where he's been the last couple of years, and that's 10, 11, 12, 13 under par, somewhere around there.
Rex Hoggard, senior golf writer with the Golf Channel, is our guest taking Dead Aim. A reminder, the Golf Channel with exclusive coverage of the Tour Championship through Sunday. I was talking with Ron Green Jr. earlier, and he and I disagree on this. I think the toothpaste is out of the tube. I don't think bifurcation will ever happen. And there's already bifurcation in terms of our clubs aren't their clubs. But in terms of rolling things back, I just don't see that happening. He thinks it might happen within 5 years. Where do you stand on that in terms of, do you think we will ever see bifurcation in the pro game where they're rolling back equipment?
I think so. And I don't know if that's going to be the golf ball or the driver or any other different way we can use to sort of bifurcate the game and to make what the top 1% of the top 1% do week in and week out on the PGA Tour versus what you and I do on the weekend, right? I mean, I don't know about you, but none of my friends are complaining about hitting the ball too far or being too consistent with the driver. I think it's a uniquely tour issue, and eventually I think the tour is going to have to embrace this. Now, the USGA and the RNA will be the first to do it when they release the distance study that they began, or later this year that they talked about at the Open Championship. But I think I'm kind of with Ron. I think we might see something in the next few years only because it's kind of like slow play. Once people start speaking loud enough, and once the bigger names start speaking loud enough about this, that someone will pay attention.
Rex, I always like Jay Monahan's State of the Union address that comes this week at Eastlake. He covered a couple of topics that I thought were very interesting. The first is one that's really, I think, been blown out of proportion the last couple of weeks, and that's the slow play issue. It's ironic in that this issue blew up because of something that was a PGA Tour initiative, and that's PGA Tour Live and their groups that they show unedited on Thursday and Friday mornings, and it just so happened they had Bryson DeChambeau on there on a day where he's taking, 2 minutes to make an 8-foot putt. But he, gave lip service to the fact that, we've got this slow play issue under control. We got this. We've met about it. We're excited about the way it's going. But to me, it was just sort of lip service. The European Tour made some strides, or at least an effort this week, at what they consider the problem to be. Do you see the PGA Tour actually doing something, or just making a lot of noise saying they're going to do something?
There's nothing more boring to me than talking about slow play, and that includes watching slow play on TV.
So Rex Hoggard's answer, the only thing more boring than watching slow play is talking about slow play.
Yeah, I do think something's going to come of this. Now, will it be sweeping enough that it's going to revolutionize the game? Absolutely not. I mean, we're talking about minutes here. We're not talking about taking hours off. However, I do think at some point, Jay, who I think has come around a little bit more on this than his predecessor, Tim Fintan, did, that he realizes that the product is being harmed, particularly when you have a situation like they had at the Northern Trust just a few weeks ago, when you actually have players in a public forum like social media calling each other out like we did with Bryson DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka and some others. So I think that's going to be something that's going to motivate this. But again, I don't know if it's going to be these dramatic changes, which you'll probably end up seeing as a combination of what the European Tour has done and will do going in the future, a little bit more focused timing, a little bit more emphasis on the players that you know on tour that are slow, as opposed to just maybe slap a penalty on a guy. I don't see that happen, not anytime soon at least.
All right, well, let's move on and let's talk about what's happening at Eastlake this week. I'm remaining open-minded, even though I don't know how I feel about somebody like Justin Thomas, who just blew away Medina, getting shots from everyone in the field. And then, I liked it when everything got reset at the Tour Championship, and, that was it. How do the players feel about this, or are they taking sort of a wait-and-see approach as well?
They're saying the right thing, but I think they're taking a wait-and-see approach. I think everyone still has to wrap their mind around this. And what's interesting to me is if you looked at the old system, it was overly confusing to your average golf fan. And I say that kind of as an average golf fan. I'm at every tour event, so I'm probably more than that. But the fact is, it was hard to wrap your mind around this point system where you go into Sunday at Eastlake and you're not 100% sure at any given moment what actually could play out. And so now you've taken that and you've turned it into, which is the opposite, which is very, very easy. The average golf fan to understand that if you just win this event, you finish with the lowest score of the week, you're going to win the FedEx Cup. So I think on that front, they've made a lot of very good progress. Where it's going to be difficult is the guys, the players specifically, they know that JT is starting at 10 under, and if you're Lucas Glover, you're starting at even par for the week. And eventually, we're going to have a scenario where if this system would have been in place last year, Tiger Woods would not have won the Tour Championship. Justin Rose would have. And can you imagine the outroar over that? And I think that's where you're going to run into problems because, look, players are appreciative of everything that FedEx has brought to the game. However, this is a competitive issue. I mean, Justin Thomas said it himself this afternoon that if he were to win this and not have shot the lowest score for the week, but because of the way the stroke space works, it would bother him.
Golf Channel senior writer Rex Hoggard is our guest taking Dead Aim. Reminder, the Golf Channel with exclusive coverage along with NBC of the Tour Championship through Sunday. Thank you for bringing up Tiger Woods. As dramatic as the Masters win was, and I don't think anybody can name a highlight that was better than that in the golf season this year, what we saw at Eastlake last year with the almost, Bobby Jones in 1930 crowds crashing through. It was an unbelievable sight when he got back into the winner's circle. We really, truly have a changing of the guard at the Tour Championship this year, as for the first time in my golf viewing life, it feels like there's no Tiger and no Phil. Does it have that sort of changing of the guard feel to you as well?
I think it's been coming. Yeah, I don't know if this week it just crystallized. Maybe it did, now that you mentioned that. I know that people have spoken about it. But I really think it's been coming when you consider that the best players in the game now are of a certain age. And by that, I mean mid to 30-ish, you know, to mid to late 20s, I guess. And all of them kind of fit the same mold, where it's Brooks Koepka or Rory McIlroy or Jordan Spieth or JT or whoever the case may be. And so they have kind of moved into that sort of semi-leadership role. They've moved into that sort of semi-veteran role because now you have these incredibly talented and hungry young players that are coming out on tour and winning immediately. I'm thinking Matthew Wolff and Colin McCauley and all these great young players. And it's quickly transitioning, skewing to a younger and younger tour. So I think we've seen it coming for a while. But, yeah, not having those two in the field this week certainly crystallizes it much more.
The two names that I keep coming back to as far as this tournament, based on their seeding and everything else, I just keep thinking, okay, if Brooks Koepka can somehow find himself to get motivated for $15 million and or if Rory can putt, they're my two favorites. Is there anyone else that you say, you know what, don't be surprised if blank wins this week?
I mean, Justin Thomas has a two-stroke lead already, and they haven't put a peg in the ground. So I'm going to go with JT. I really like his chances starting at 10 under par. And I think he's playing well, as evidenced by last week. He's played this event well. He almost he's won here in the past. He hasn't won. He's won the FedEx Cup. He hasn't won the Tour Championship. So I think he would be a guy you need to keep your eye on. But the thing that about this new scoring that I particularly like, and there's a lot of things to look at and to worry about and to kind of have a concern about how they may unfold on Sunday. But one part I do like is that the guys on the back half of the points list, let's say from 20 to 30, I think they have a much better chance now of winning the FedEx Cup than they ever had before, because before so many things had to fall their way and other players had to do so many different things. Whereas now, I mean, if you look at a guy like Lucas Glover, he's starting tomorrow 10 strokes back. Sounds like a lot, but he probably started 10 strokes back with 36 holes to go and made a good run at it. I mean, Brooks Koepka brought up today that he was 7 strokes back once and came back to win. So I don't know if it's nearly as daunting of a task as it used to be for the guys on the back half of the field, which in my mind is going to open up a lot more contenders than maybe we've seen in the past.
You know, the only reason why I didn't bring up JT's name is one thing that I'm starting to see as a trend that we got spoiled in Tiger's heyday. It was nothing for us to see Tiger win an Open Championship and then the next week go win a WGC event and then the next week win something else. He was able to somehow keep it going week in, week out, and win on the PGA Tour. And it just seems that winning on the PGA Tour now is such a physical and mental and psychological toll that doing it back-to-back weeks, it's unheard of now.
It really is. And I think part of that, well, I think the large portion of that, to be honest, is the depth. And I'm always very, very careful when you talk about, the depth, that the quality of field that Tiger played against versus the quality of field that you see on tour now, it's always a difficult conversation, right? But I truly believe that now, as opposed to maybe earlier in Tiger's career, you show up at an event like this week, and there's 15 or 20 guys that honestly probably have a legitimate chance of winning. That probably changed dramatically back when Tiger was in his prime, when there was, if we're being honest, 5 or 10 guys who had a legitimate chance to change. I think that's all about depth in golf right now.
Golf Channel senior writer Rex Hoggard is our guest taking Dead Aim. A reminder, the Golf Channel, along with NBC Live, exclusive coverage of the Tour Championship through Sunday. Get you out of here on this. Back to Commissioner Monahan's press conference earlier this week. And he brought up something that he used the word priority, and I was kind of stunned because I didn't even know it was a thing, and that is the concept of having the LPGA and the PGA Tour play an event simultaneously. How far off is this actually in happening if he's made it a quote-unquote priority?
Well, the priority word stands out in that comment. The other word is you got the impression he wanted to say something more. You got the impression that there's probably ink that isn't quite dry on a contract somewhere that's going to end up with a dual event with LPGA players playing with PGA Tour players. And they were close years ago of getting that to work for a Tournament of Champions in Maui. And for a lot of different reasons, that didn't pan out. But I do think it's something that's important to both tours. And I think it's important to the growth of the game right now, to be honest with you. And we've had skin game in the past and some other things. But for this to be a full-scale official event for both tours, I think would just be fantastic. And there's plenty of precedent. I mean, we have a team event now in New Orleans. Certainly, we have a lot of cup team events. And I think this would be very good for the growth of the game overall.
Love getting the opportunity to pick that man's brain. That's senior writer with the Golf Channel, Rex Hoggard. A reminder, Golf Channel and NBC, live exclusive coverage of the Tour Championship through Sunday. I'd also like to thank Carolina amateur golfing icon and current USGA four-ball champion, Scott Harvey, and Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now, links to articles on the latest goings on in and around the game. Weather-wise, we may have to dodge some showers. It's August after all, but the weather is unseasonably cool and perfect in the Carolinas to tee it up this weekend and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.